melodrama of the 19th century, he muttered, "What's next week, East Lynne?" Stilted though it may have been, the opening scene captured the critics. Daughter of a governor, niece of a senator, born to politics, Bethune Clark Church glanced automatically over at the press gallery when O'Mahony agreed to accept the amendment, and what she saw was rows of reporters jumping up like a wave and running up the stairs to the telephones in the press room. Then the rest of Johnson's scenario unfolded. The Rhode Island bantam with the nimble mind asked for recognition from the chair. No one, not even Johnson's staff, knew what John Pastor was going to do, says Silas Horwitz, who had been invited to sit in a folding chair next to Johnson to watch the show. Lyndon did because he said, "Now you just watch the little Italian dancing master and see what happens here." Johnson had cast Pastor in a demanding role, that of a skeptic and doubter who, by giving voice to his doubts, convinces himself that they are groundless and is converted into a true believer. The subject of his doubts, of course, was the jury trial amendment. Johnson had arranged with Pastor to, in Mann's words, feign skepticism of the amendment, to raise the questions about it that many senators were asking, and then to think through the answers to the questions out loud. And finally, seeing the validity of the answers, to be convinced by them, to almost imperceptibly dissolve his skepticism into outright support for the amendment. The Rhode Islander began to ask questions of O'Mahony, the questions that many senators, uncertain about the amendment, were asking themselves. Would the amendment, for example, permit a Southern registrar who had been jailed by a judge for civil contempt and then freed when he promised to register Negroes, then be able to violate his promise and be in effect immune from punishment, because that violation would be criminal contempt, and he would therefore be eligible for trial before a sympathetic jury that would not convict him? When O'Mahony replied that there was no danger of this because the judge would have ordered the registrar to register Negroes, and any violation of this order would still be civil, not criminal contempt, Pastor said, "I think the senator from Wyoming is moving a little too quickly. I think I know what he means, but I do not believe the record is abundantly clear." And led O'Mahony through the reasoning again step by step until the densest senator could grasp it. And with each question that he asked, Pastor reiterated that he was asking it only to try to resolve his own doubts, that he still had an open mind. "I have not as yet definitely resolved the matter in my own mind." As he assured himself on point after point, after saying on point after point, "I have not been able to make up my mind," his misgivings about the amendment faded to be replaced by support. All of this had been pre-planned, Horwitz was to realize, and Pastor did one of the most effective jobs that was ever done. His colloquy with O'Mahony riveted the attention of both sides of the aisle. There were senators, Republican conservatives from the Midwest, most of them, who still had sincere questions about the amendment. From far across the floor, Thigh of Minnesota, hater of Democrats, interrupted to ask a question of a Democrat. "The senator from Rhode Island was making a very impressive statement," Thigh said. "He asked a question. I am as vitally concerned with the answer to that question as he is. If he, O'Mahony, has the answer, I hope he will give it." And while O'Mahony was giving it, during the entire long colloquy, in fact, the chamber was so still that although the two Democrats' desks, both in the third row, were somewhat far to the side of the chamber, and only three desks apart, no one in the chamber had any difficulty hearing them. By the time Pastor finished resolving his doubts, in favor of the jury trial amendment, and said earnestly, "I cannot subscribe to the argument that the amendment would be emasculating the bill. I cannot go along with that argument," he had convinced others. The show Johnson had staged produced the result he wanted. "The impact of Pastor's performance was profound," Mann writes. "He played the role of an earnest, undecided senator, but he had actually led his colleagues through a crafty, subtle argument for the amendment." All through Senate history, there had been speeches that made senators rethink their views. This was one of them. "It actually changed some votes," George Reedy says. And the next morning, Thursday, August 1st, brought to Lyndon Johnson's office the telegram he had been waiting for, a statement signed by the presidents of the 12 railroad brotherhoods. It was much shorter than John L. Lewis's and quite straightforward. We favor the enactment of an amendment to the Civil Rights Bill that would preserve or extend the right to trial by jury. Now Johnson had all the ammunition he needed. That morning, Welly Hopkins telephoned him to ask how things were going. They were going just fine, Johnson said. Hopkins recalls that Johnson mentioned certain senators. He said, "I've got them. I'm just going to pick my time to call them. That's when I'm going to put it to a vote." And that day, August 1st, Lyndon Johnson sprang his trap. William Noland walked straight into it, blind till the last. That very Thursday morning, at about the same time that Johnson was telling Hopkins that everything was going fine, Noland was telling reporters, and the White House and Vice President Nixon, that everything was going fine, and reiterating his confidence that at least 39 or 40 Republican senators would join at least a dozen Democratic liberals in voting against the jury trial amendment. Asked by a reporter whether Church's addendum would strip away any of the Republican votes, the Republican leader said he thought not. That morning, copies of the Brotherhood's telegram were delivered to the offices of individual senators, to be followed by visits from Cy Anderson and other union lobbyists. Pastor's logic had had time to sink in, and that morning Lyndon Johnson made his calls, and after several of them erased the number that he had placed next to senators' names in one column on his tally sheet, and wrote a number in the other column. Richard Russell was also keeping his own very careful tally sheet, and early that afternoon he told Johnson, "I'm ready to vote. I've got 50 votes." Noland, however, still believed his own vote count. At any time, he might realize the truth, and if he did, he would naturally change tactics. Stop pressing for an early vote and instead try to delay one. Votes had been changing back and forth for days, and White House pressure might well change some back again. A delay would afford time for that pressure to do its work. So Johnson made it very difficult for Noland to change tactics. In a private talk now, he said he assumed that Noland still wanted to vote as soon as possible. Noland said he did, and Johnson quickly made those feelings public. Interrupting an exchange about the bill, he said, "I have conferred with the minority leader. I know how anxious he is for an early vote. I am equally anxious to vote, and I express the hope that we may be able to call the roll before the evening is over." Turning to Noland, who was standing next to him, he said, "I would assume that meets with the pleasure of my friend from California." His friend from California said, "Yes, I wish to say that I am encouraged by the remarks of my good friend, the senator from Texas, that he feels we may be approaching a time when we can get a vote." Later that afternoon, the GOP had yet another encounter with reality. While Noland couldn't count, Nixon could, and coming to the Capitol, he did so, and promptly launched a frantic Republican lobbying campaign. One after another, GOP senators were summoned to the vice president's room for, in Douglas Cater's words, "the kind of subtle persuasion an administration in office can exert." General Persons hurried over from the White House, and so did Postmaster General Arthur E. Summerfield, who, as Cater puts it, suddenly found it a matter of convenience to discuss postmaster appointments. Deputy Attorney General William P. Rogers arrived to answer senators' technical questions. But at 5:40 p.m., Lyndon Johnson asked for recognition from the chair to propose a unanimous consent agreement to set a time for the vote on the jury trial amendment. And the majority leader didn't propose his own agreement, but rather the very same agreement that had been proposed on Wednesday, had been proposed three times on Wednesday, by the minority leader. "Mr. President," Lyndon Johnson said, "yesterday the distinguished minority leader offered a unanimous consent agreement. I wish to offer the same agreement today with two modifications." The modifications would bring on the vote even faster than the distinguished minority leader had wanted. Noland had, for example, allowed 6 hours for debate on the amendment. "In view of the fact that we have spent a good deal of time today on the bill, I am reducing the hours from 6 to 4, Johnson said. Noland, aware now that the vote would be at the least very close, said he still preferred 6, and Johnson suavely said that that was fine with him. Noland could offer no other objection. He could hardly object to an agreement he himself had proposed over and over, telling the Senate each time how vital its passage was. As they realized the significance of Johnson's proposal and the reason why he had made it, Liberal senators from both sides of the aisle gathered in little groups on the floor, trying to think what they could do about it. But they could do no more than Noland had. If Noland had proposed the agreement yesterday, they had supported it with equal vehemence. They were hardly in a position to object to it now. Spessard Holland, in the chair, asked, "Is there objection to the unanimous consent request?" There was only silence. "The chair hears none, and it is so ordered," Holland said. Johnson then addressed the chair again. "The vote on the jury trial amendment would probably take place that very evening," he said. "It is the intention of the leadership to remain here until a vote is had." Irving Ives asked, "When does the debate start? Does it start right now?" "Right now," Lyndon Johnson said. Checkmate. The rest was anticlimax. Offstage, off the floor, the Republican efforts intensified now that the vice president was directing them in person. Aware now that every vote was needed, the GOP managed to contact Maine's Senator Frederick G. Payne, who had been recuperating from a heart attack and was at his fishing camp in the Maine woods, and persuaded him to fly to Washington for the vote. Other attempts were less successful, however. Sheppel and Butler had been two votes of which Noland had been confident, but now it was suddenly realized that that confidence had not been justified. General Persons telephoned the White House to have Eisenhower speak to the two senators in person. Ann Whitman had to tell the general that the president was out on the golf course at Burning Tree. Whitman managed to get in touch with him there, and he agreed to see Sheppel, but when Persons attempted to contact the senator to arrange a time for the appointment, it proved so difficult that it became obvious that Sheppel was avoiding Persons. "Senator Butler also would not come to see the president," Whitman wrote in her diary. That evening, Joe Rao and Paul Sifton, chief lobbyist for Reuther's UAW, bumped into Nixon and Rogers right outside the chamber. "They stopped us, and we compared notes on how the votes were going to go, and it was clear it was going to go very badly," Rao was to recall. "It was clear that Johnson had the votes." Nixon could barely contain his anger. Encountering Johnson in the Senate reception room, he said, smiling tightly, "You've really got your bullwhip on your boys tonight, Lyndon." As he started to walk by, Johnson replied angrily, "Yes, Dick, and from the way you've been trying to drive your fellows, you must have a 30-30 strapped to your hip. But it's not doing you any good." "Just wait," Nixon said grimly, and incorrectly. "You'll find out." The setting was the Senate chamber, of course. The word had gone out through official Washington that the big vote would be that evening, and the galleries in the chamber had begun to fill up early in the evening, not with visitors to the city, but with its own people, men and women connected with or fascinated by government, who wanted to see one of government's big shows. Evening became night, a hot, muggy Washington summer night. And more spectators came in from dinner parties, some of which had been formal parties at foreign embassies, and in the galleries were jewels and bare shoulders and white shirt fronts and dark suits. The Capitol dome was lit. It gleamed over Washington, high above the men and women walking toward the long, shadowy eastern facade or driving down Pennsylvania Avenue. The visitors came in out of the dark evening, up the broad marble stairs and between the tall columns, through the bronze doors, into corridors sparkling with the crystal and cut glass of chandeliers, and they walked along those corridors past the busts of statesmen and the paintings of heroes, under the richly hued frescoes, into the galleries rimming the long high-ceilinged room with its pale walls and its four glowing mahogany arcs, until finally even the aisles in the galleries were filled to overflowing, spectators sitting on each step. There are times, they are very rare, when a scene worth remembering, a moment of real drama and meaning, occurs on the Senate floor, Stuart Alsop was to write. This was such a moment. It was a scene of a sort that occurs only once or twice in a decade. Every fit senator on the floor and the galleries choked with spectators. All present, spectators and senators alike, were caught up in the excitement of the great Senate game. A man's pulse can be quickened, after all, by a close contest at chess or on the golf course. But there is nothing quite like the Senate game. Below the spectators, among the arcs of desks, senators were making speeches as senators had been making speeches among the desks since the birth of the Republic. There were speeches by liberals assailing the amendment. "Somehow this debate got off on the wrong foot," Hubert Humphrey said. Somehow or other, we have been more concerned about those who have abused the law, who have denied people the equal protection of the law, than we have been with those who have been victimized. Paul Douglas said, "All that the pending bill seeks to do is to permit the government of the United States to come into the lists in defense of the poor, the weak, the disinherited, and the disenfranchised. The proposal to inject a jury trial will, if adopted, nullify the law in most cases." Liberals had become furious as there sunk in on them the realization that they had been outgeneraled and that their victory was about to be snatched away from them in that vote that was suddenly so close upon them. "I hope some of my colleagues will give real and serious thought to whether the Church Amendment, which was offered so recently, is really understood by the members of this august body who are being called upon to pass it at this time," Joe Clark said. Some of the liberals cited past cases, such as the one in Alabama's Bullock County, to prove that Southern justice could not be trusted. Cliff Case asked that the judge's opinion in Sellers et al. Versus S.B. Wilson et al. Be read into the record, and said the outcome of this travesty of justice proved the need for a stronger bill. "What happened, Mr. President?" Case cried. "All members of the board resigned. The court found, of course, that it was unable to grant the relief because there was no one on whom its order could operate. Mr. President, I suggest that the opponents of the pending legislation from those states do not come before the Senate with clean hands." There were speeches by liberals emphasizing that it was only the addition of the church addendum that made it possible for them to vote for the jury trial amendment. "A vote against this amendment is not only a vote against the jury trial," old Jim Murray said. "It is also a vote against the rights of Negroes to serve on our federal juries. I cannot cast a vote against two elementary civil rights." There was also a speech by Frank Church. Many speeches in great Senate debates since the birth of the Republic were bombast for the record, but there were some in this debate that were more than that, and Church's was one of them. "I can still see him standing there in that back row, so tall and straight," his wife was to say more than 40 years later. "Senator Sunday School." And she was not the only one in the Senate chamber who was moved, particularly by the part of the speech in which the young senator was echoing the argument of his leader, that the most important consideration was to take a first step, even if it was not a perfect step. "Civil rights legislation is long overdue," Frank Church said, "but in no field of legislative endeavor must we build more carefully or more thoughtfully than here. This field bears the same relationship to other legislative fields as the building of a cathedral bears to the building of a factory. In the field of civil rights, we give voice to the finest impulses of our humanity. Our workaday structures, as our workaday laws, may be built with ordinary materials, but we must build our places of worship and our laws of liberty with the finest of materials and the greatest of care. These we build for the ages. Mr. President, I submit that our work in safeguarding civil rights cannot be accomplished in a single stroke. This law is but a single step. It is a law confined to voting rights. It may well be that in the future this bill may need to be enlarged. If we provide proper procedures in this bill that accord with the timeless principles of our ancient law, then we will find it possible in years to come to enlarge the scope of this bill. But if we depart from our traditional procedures in this bill, our departure will haunt us as a recurring barrier to enlarging the scope of civil rights in future years. That is why I am persuaded that this amendment is indispensable to the long-term interest of civil rights." And there was a speech by another young senator, 40-year-old John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who also sat in the back row, a speech explaining why he had now, at last, decided to support the amendment. His explanation was based in part on pragmatism. "One reason to give the Southerners what they want," he said, "is to avoid a filibuster. After observing the course of debate during the past days, I am persuaded that if the O'Mahony Amendment is not accepted, the passage of the bill will be delayed for weeks and perhaps indefinitely," he said. It was buttressed with expert opinion from outstanding liberal attorneys whom I have consulted. "I ask unanimous consent to have printed at this point in the record a memorandum which is the result of a telephone conversation with Professor Mark DeWolf Howe, Professor of Law, Harvard Law School." And it displayed concern not to offend the South, whose votes might be crucial at the 1960 convention. I am confident that Southern juries, presented with convincing evidence and ever mindful of the watching eyes of the nation, and indeed the world, will convict those who dare to interfere with orderly legal processes, Kennedy said. But in its peroration, Kennedy's speech rose to an eloquence that gave a hint of things to come. Finally, Mr. President, this debate represents a turning point in American social and political thought. It represents a confrontation of problems which have plagued us too long. It represents an almost universal acknowledgement that we cannot continue to command the respect of peoples everywhere, not to mention our own self-respect, while we ignore the fact that many of our citizens do not possess basic constitutional rights. However late, we have at last come to the point of a great decision. It is this fact which overshadows our deliberations. To this overarching achievement, history will bear witness. All during the hours consumed by speeches, however, the focus of the gallery's attention was on Lyndon Johnson, who wasn't speaking. Johnson wanted it there, and he made sure it stayed there. This evening session of the Senate was his moment, and he made the most of it. And to any spectator who had arrived wondering who was going to be the victor in the great Senate game, or who was in charge on the Senate floor, his actions made the answers clear. Dressed in a dark blue suit and gleaming white shirt, with a bright bow tie and, in his breast pocket, a bright handkerchief, he sauntered up and down the aisles with long, loping strides, stopping by one desk to put an arm around a colleague's shoulders, grinning widely at another, gesturing across the floor at another, bending close to still others to whisper in their ears, sometimes with a hand ostentatiously held up to his mouth to make the spectators realize that something secret and important was being said, so that, even though other senators were speaking, he constantly caught the gallery's eye. When he sat down at his desk, of course, he was sitting down front and center on the Senate stage, and at the adjoining desk, on the other side of the center aisle, was the perfect foil. There were many speakers, but the floor was wholly dominated by two big men, stationed cheek by jowl on the center aisle, big, chunky, earnest minority leader William Noland, and lanky majority leader Lyndon Johnson, Stuart Alsop wrote. They made a fascinating contrast. Noland sat stolidly, like a great cornered bull, his enormous forehead furrowed in parallel wrinkles, foretasting defeat. Johnson sat back easily, his long legs negligently crossed, when he was not moving restlessly about. Once, when Everett Dirksen of Illinois rose to support Noland with his special brand of empty grandiloquence, "I have been thinking much of Runnymede." Johnson half yawned and lazily scratched his chest in a magnificent gesture of casual confidence. The speeches didn't matter. Johnson's every gesture made that clear. What mattered was the votes, and he had the votes. Finally, after Dirksen had finished, Noland rose to make a last appeal, poignant because by this time even he knew what its result would be. "This will be a historic roll call. Let it come. Our successors and history will be able to judge the issues, even if for the moment there is confusion here tonight." He ended by bellowing out a line that must have been difficult for him to say, but which he may have felt represented the only hope left for him. "Support our president, Dwight D. Eisenhower," he shouted. Then, as the hands on the clock neared midnight and Nixon came in to take the presiding officer's chair, a page placed a lectern on the majority leader's desk, and Johnson himself rose to give the last speech. "Mr. President, sometimes in the course of debate we use loose language, but it is not speaking loosely to say that the Senate is approaching a truly historic vote. By adopting this amendment, we can strengthen and preserve two important rights. One is the right to a trial by jury. The other is the right of all Americans to serve on juries, regardless of race, creed, or color." And his last line was the perfect climax, the most fitting last line, the only last line, really, for a legislative drama. "Mr. President," Lyndon Johnson said, "I ask for the yeas and nays." For a time, to those in the galleries, the vote may have seemed to be going against the leader. The first two senators called, Aiken and Allet, responded nay, and at the end of 25 names, with the roll just finishing the D's, the tally was 16-9 against the amendment. But Johnson, sitting at his desk with the smudged tally sheet in front of him, wasn't worried. He knew what was coming, and with the start of the ease, it came. Eastland? Aye. Ellender? Aye. Irvin? Aye. By the time the clerk reached the M's, the I's were ahead. And so many of the M's were from the mountain states in the northwest. Magnuson? Aye. Malone? Aye. Mansfield? Aye. Murray? Aye. Shortly after midnight, at 12:19 a.m. on August 2nd, Nixon announced that the amendment was approved by 51 votes to 42. Before the last words were out of Nixon's mouth, a senator jumped up at his desk on the far left-hand side of the Democratic arc and started not for the cloakroom but for the lobby, because that was where the closest telephone was. He was a senator who no longer moved very fast because he was old, but he was moving as fast as he could. It was Joseph O'Mahony. His wife, Agnes, was in a wheelchair and hadn't been able to come. He was hurrying to call her to give her the news. In the wake of the vote, emotions spilled over. Richard Nixon could not contain his frustration and rage. When, as he was leaving the chamber, reporters asked his reaction, the vice president said, "This is one of the saddest days in the history of the Senate. It was a vote against the right to vote." Clarence Mitchell went to Nolan's office to discuss what to do now and could hardly believe what he saw there. "That big, strong, brusque Nolan actually broke down and cried," Mitchell was to recall. What overflowed in Bethune Church was pride. She had been sitting in the family gallery all evening, and when the vote began, she did not know how it was going to go. "You couldn't take notes in the gallery, so I was tallying the vote on my hands and feet," she was to recall. The vote went, of course, the way her husband wanted it to go, and when I left the gallery, I was so excited. She hoped there was awareness of Frank's importance in the civil rights fight, and as she was leaving the Capitol that night, she found out there was. "I got to the bottom floor, and I started through the swinging doors, and Jack Kennedy caught my arm as I was going through the door, and he said, 'Your man pulled it off. He did a great job.'" Kennedy wasn't alone in that assessment. "After my role in the passage of that civil rights legislation, Lyndon Johnson was warmly and massively grateful. So much so that I was almost stifled in his embrace," Frank Church said. "He would pick you up and wrap his arms around you and just squeeze the air out." The gratitude of the leader took tangible forms. At a cocktail party early in the year, Bethune, talking with a group of people, had remarked that she had always wanted to visit South America. Johnson had heard her, and 2 weeks after the jury trial vote, she was in South America. After the vote, Johnson named her husband the Senate's representative to a 10-day conference in Buenos Aires of the Organization of American States. The assignment was a kind of indication of his new friendship and embrace, Church realized. There were other indications. "Nothing was too good for me," Church was to say. "First," in March 1958, "he put me on the McClellan Labor Rackets Committee, which was about to begin its publicity-rich hearings into the Teamsters Union and Jimmy Hoffa, and told Church why he was doing so. 'I've got a vacancy there to fill, and it will give you some good exposure. I think it will be good for you.' And then there was the committee appointment for which Church had longed. After a decent interval, after the jury trial addendum, Johnson put him on foreign relations in what was a tacit quid pro quo, which was never expressed, but which I think was understood," Ward Hauer says. Actually, the interval was barely decent. The very next vacancy on foreign relations occurred in January 1959, and Church was appointed to it. In making the appointment, Johnson simply bypassed not only Estes Kefauver, but Scoop Jackson and a half dozen other senators with greater seniority than Church who had requested the post. Church had wanted not only to go on the committee, but to go on early so that he could be chairman like Bora someday. Now he had gone on early, calling on its staff director, Carl Marcy, not long after his appointment. He looked at the portraits of the committee chairman hanging on the wall and said, "Maybe someday I'll be there." And there was a note, undated, but it was probably written in 1958, scribbled by Lyndon Johnson one day when he was sitting in on a meeting of the Interior Committee of which Church was a member. A note that indicates how accurately Johnson had read the easy-to-follow text that was Frank Church. "Frank," the note said, "I told Drew Pearson yesterday I wanted him to help me give you a build-up over the years that would give you the recognition your ability deserves. Someday you can, may, and should be our president." Chapter 41. Omens. The passage of the jury trial amendment, coming on top of the elimination of Part 3, infuriated Republicans. Those who had been fighting for Brownell's unamended bill out of a sincere belief in civil rights, because they felt that those two changes rendered the original bill meaningless. Those who had been fighting for political advantage for the GOP, because they felt the advantage had been lost. They sought to regain it. Fuming from his long and fruitless day trying to win back GOP senators, Vice President Nixon, flanked by Deputy Attorney General Rogers, was heading out for dinner on the evening of the jury trial vote when he encountered Joe Rao and Paul Sifton in a Senate corridor. They had a brief conversation, the conversation in which all four agreed that they were about to lose that vote, and then Nixon said, "Boys, I think we ought to consider whether the best strategy wouldn't be to just let the civil rights bill die in conference this year, and then make an all-out fight for a stronger bill next year." President Eisenhower, informed of the result when he awoke the next morning, could not have been angrier if he had missed an easy putt. He opened that day's cabinet meeting by calling the Senate action one of the most serious political defeats of the past 4 years, primarily because of a denial of a basic principle of the United States, the right to vote. And his formal statement at that day's press conference, read with a grim expression on his face, was one of the angriest he had ever made publicly about Congress. "Rarely in our entire legislative history have so many extraneous issues been introduced into the debate," he said, adding how bitterly disappointing the vote had been to millions of Americans who will continue to be disenfranchised. "The blackest of black days," Ann Whitman wrote in her diary. The gutting of the bill, even with Church's addendum to the jury trial amendment, infuriated some African American leaders. Among those who urged Eisenhower not to sign it were some from a new generation, like Jackie Robinson, who telegraphed, "Have waited this long for bill with meaning, can wait a little longer," and some from the old, like A. Philip Randolph, who said, "It is worse than no bill at all." And some black Americans blamed Lyndon Johnson for the gutting. Ethel Payne, who was covering the Senate for the Chicago Defender, was to recall how, "We all sat watching while Lyndon Johnson, the most astute maneuverer on the Hill, cracked his whip and marshaled his forces to cut the guts and the heart out of the bill." And the changes infuriated liberals, who saw the addendum as a cynical device to give the appearance of meaningfulness to something that had no meaning, since Southern juries would almost certainly include at least one white. "Can one then picture a jury from the Deep South unanimously finding a white election official guilty for depriving a Negro of the right to vote?" Paul Douglas asked. "A hung jury is almost as good as an acquittal." Church's idealistic young staff members Ward and Phyllis Hauer felt their senator had been wrong to introduce it. So emotional was Phyllis about it that for weeks she could barely bring herself to talk to her boss. "What good was the bill as a whole?" liberals asked. "The jury trial amendment rendered toothless the provisions about voting, and voting was now the only right covered by the bill." "The federal government is still prevented from coming to the aid of hard-pressed citizens whose civil rights to unsegregated schooling, transportation, and other public facilities are denied," Paul Douglas said. "These people, who are almost universally poor and weak, must still fight their costly and protracted legal battles alone. It has been the advocates of segregation and white domination who have won the major triumph." An old man who for years had stood shoulder to shoulder with Douglas and who had left the Senate battlefield because he was afraid he could no longer be effective on it, had been anxiously following the debate in a congressional record that he had arranged to have flown every day to his hotel in Switzerland, and he wrote to console his longtime ally. "I know how deeply you have felt on this subject and of your inevitable sense of disappointment and frustration," Herbert Lehman wrote. I want you to know, however, how much I have admired your leadership. What you have done has been one of the few bright spots in an otherwise very gloomy and frightening situation." But Lehman had to confess that he himself was sorely disappointed. The bill in its present form will be merely a gesture and quite ineffective. The anger of such liberals focused on Lyndon Johnson. "I was so mad at Johnson I was speechless for gutting the bill so much," recalls Joe Rao, and was given voice by liberal columnists. On August 5th, for example, Thomas Stokes denounced the sham perpetrated upon the Senate and the American people, which intrudes upon the human dignity of millions of persons who for a long time have suffered denial of guaranteed rights which the rest of us take for granted. The civil rights fiasco in the Senate was admittedly a triumph for the Southern wing, Stokes wrote. It was, too, a compliment, if of dubious character, for the ingenious and slick leadership of Senator Lyndon Johnson of Texas. In this case, he virtually compromised the civil rights bill out of existence in the zeal of exercising his talents of maneuver and behind-the-scenes negotiations of which he is so proud. Looking back on it all, we might say that never was strategy so brilliant to bring about so evil a result. The New York Post, which had been denouncing Richard Nixon for years, said that in this fight, Lyndon Johnson had made even Nixon look good. Frustration and anger led some Republican senators at first to favor the course that Nixon had suggested in the Senate corridor. Somehow, the civil rights issue, which was their issue, had been captured by the Democrats. The Republicans are understandably quite furious that Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, the Senate Democratic leader, is now getting the credit of sorts for having navigated a civil rights bill through the Senate without a filibuster, Roland Evans wrote. And if the Democrats got credit, the Republicans might well get blame. The bill had been stripped of its enforcement provisions, and the burden of enforcement would fall on a Republican Justice Department. When enforcement efforts failed, as thanks to the jury trial amendment, they would inevitably fail, the Republicans, not the Democrats, will have to make the explanations to disillusioned Negro voters, Evans wrote. The solution for the GOP might lie in the next stage of the bill's legislative journey. The House had passed a bill, Brownell's original bill, a bill that included Part 3 and did not include any provision for jury trials, very different from the bill the Senate had passed. The two bills had to be reconciled, and unless some unusual step was taken, they would go for reconciliation to a joint House-Senate Conference Committee. Southern representatives and senators were generally heavily represented on these committees, which also included key members of the committees into whose jurisdiction the bill fell. So not only Judiciary's Olin Johnston, but Judiciary's Chairman Jim Eastland might well be members of the Senate delegation. If a compromise could not be agreed on, the bill would die in conference. That prospect was not at all displeasing to some Republicans. Since the bill could only hurt their party, why not just let it die? Since the conference committee would be dominated by Democrats, Democrats would be blamed for the death, and civil rights would then be a potent issue for the GOP in the 1958 election year. It would be infinitely better to let the bill die and wait 3 months, until January 1958, when the next session of Congress would begin, and get a real bill, House GOP leader Joseph Martin said. In the first flush of resentment over the jury trial amendment, those senators who were derided as the all-out civil rights forces felt the same way. Nixon's suggestion had struck a responsive chord in the deeply disappointed Rao. And after the yeas and nays had confirmed their gloomy prediction and Rao was leaving the gallery, he told Paul Sifton angrily, "This bill is worth less than nothing." Leaving Sifton, he walked out of the Capitol, into the night, and felt himself seized with anger. "Well, let's kill the bill. Maybe Nixon's right," he muttered to himself. Other members of the Douglas group felt the same way. Wayne Morse said he hoped the Senate would reject this bad bill when the vote on the entire bill was taken on August 7th. And of course the South agreed. What, from Richard Russell's standpoint, had been the most desirable result all along but the death of the bill? What difference did it make, ultimately, where it was killed? If it hadn't been done on the Senate floor, then the conference committee would do just fine. While that was liberals' first reaction, however, it didn't last. Liberals and black leaders, the veteran battered crusaders for civil rights, had been fighting for so long in vain that, on more sober consideration, they realized how hard it had been to pass any civil rights bill, and how essential it was that that accomplishment, no matter how meager it was, be recognized. The morning after the 51-42 vote, Joe Rao was just getting out of bed when his telephone rang, and it was Clarence Mitchell saying, as Mitchell's biographer recounts, that the civil rights forces had to support what was left of the bill before people got the idea that the legislative process could not work in the field of civil rights. This bill, no matter how weak it was proof that the process could work, Mitchell said. Congress hadn't passed a civil rights law in 82 years, but it was on the verge of passing one now. Mitchell recognized, his biographer says, the psychological and historical importance if it was actually passed. Dealing with these leaders was made easier also by their hope that if the accomplishment was finalized, if the House and Senate versions were reconciled into one bill and the bill was signed into law, future accomplishments would become easier. Johnson's argument was being accepted, right down to its wording. Recalls Richard Bowling, "All of a sudden you started hearing it all over the place. We've got to break the virginity. You heard guys saying that thing about once they do it the first time, it won't be so hard to get them to do it the next time." And it was made easier by their understanding, since they for so long had gotten, for all their efforts, nothing, that this bill, no matter how weak it was not nothing. It may not have been much, but it was something. In addition, Johnson had on his side in Philip Graham a very potent weapon. Johnson needed that weapon. It was difficult for him to talk directly to some of these leaders, including the one who was probably the single most influential, ADA National Chairman Rao. So great was their distrust of him. So the weapon had to be deployed, no matter what the cost. By the summer of 1957, Phil was clearly exhausted and in need of rest, Catherine Graham would say. She did not know then how ill her husband was, but it was, she would write, obvious that he was high-strung and had overextended himself. They had decided, in her words, to retreat to Glenwellby, and had spent the summer playing with the children and just doing nothing, except for occasional interludes like the luncheon for Rao and Frankfurter. And then, right after the passage of the jury trial amendment, Lyndon Johnson telephoned Phil at the farm and asked him to come back to Washington to help him win passage of the Civil Rights Bill. Mrs. Graham tried to persuade him not to go. "I knew that he was very frail," she would say. "I knew that he shouldn't go up and do that." She was, however, unsuccessful. So Phil returned to Washington, somewhat to my concern, and stayed with Lyndon almost constantly for several days, working day and night, telephoning Rao and other civil rights leaders to urge them to support the bill even in its weakened form, making one call after another far into the evening. On several nights he slept on a couch in Johnson's office. Graham would, of course, have been a wonderful advocate even had he not brought with him the power of the post, so deeply did he believe in what he was fighting for. From the point of view of many political observers, what LBJ did was to take everything out of the bill except the right to vote, Mrs. Graham was to write. Phil's argument was that the only thing that really counted about the bill was the right to vote. He spent a great deal of time on the telephone with Rao, George Reedy recalls. "You could see he was very tired, nervous, but more than anyone else, I think you have to say it was he who persuaded Rao." Graham persuaded Rao, and Rao helped persuade Roy Wilkins, who in 1957 was another civil rights leader whose feelings about Lyndon Johnson were at best ambivalent. In those days, Johnson was just beginning to get religion on civil rights, Wilkins was to write in his autobiography. He dreamed of becoming president himself and knew that so long as he had Jim Crow wrapped around him, the rest of the country would see him only as a Southerner, a cornpone Southerner at that, rather than a man of national stature. So, around 1957, he began to change his course on civil rights. "With Johnson, you never quite knew if he was out to lift your heart or your wallet," Wilkins was to write. He and other black leaders had had a number of meetings with Johnson during the spring and early summer of 1957, at which he told us frankly that all he cared about was voting rights, that the bill couldn't pass with Title III. Wilkins could understand that. That was too much for Dixie, he was to say. But it was much harder to swallow the jury trial amendment. That, he was to say, was simply a device to defend segregation, not to defend the sanctity of the jury system. But Rao and other liberals worked on Wilkins. Roy, Hubert Humphrey said to him one day, if there's one thing I've learned in politics, it's never to turn your back on a crumb. And Wilkins finally agreed to call a meeting of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. The leaders of 16 organizations, the NAACP, the ADA, three Jewish organizations including the American Jewish Congress, the American Council on Human Rights, the International Elks Organization, a Quaker organization, the National Community Relations Advisory Board, and seven major labor unions to thrash the problem out. The Senate vote on the overall civil rights bill was scheduled for Wednesday evening, August 7th, and the meeting, held in the library of Rao's law firm on K Street, began on Wednesday morning. At the beginning of the day, the prevailing sentiment was to decline to support the bill, but the prevailing sentiment hadn't had Phil Graham talking to it. Joe Rao argued that once Congress had lost its virginity on civil rights, it would go on to make up for what had been lost, Wilkins wrote. Johnson, on the Senate floor, was waiting anxiously for news, and that morning Reedy handed him a note giving him some, which Reedy had received from one of the participants in the meeting, Ken Burkhead. NAACP, ADA, and other civil rights organizations are going to put out a statement about noon damning the Senate bill, but saying in effect they prefer it to no bill at all, the note said. That seemed like good news, but it turned out to be premature. All day long we argued and struggled, Rao was to recall. The most prominent African-American in that room was Wilkins. If I had gone against the bill, I think it would have collapsed, he was to say, and he was probably correct. The Republicans were for letting it die. The liberals would not have gone on against me. I had never felt quite so much on the spot, Wilkins was to recall. He was torn between the two sides. I had wanted something much stronger than the bill. I had opposed the jury trial amendment. I had winced at the arguments of old friends who said that since the South had not filibustered to kill the bill, it had to be too weak to be worth anything. On the other hand, from a dry-eyed point of view, I thought it was impossible to argue that the bill was worth less than nothing. And in the end, he says, I concluded that at the very least the measure would expand Negro registration. I also hoped that if the bill passed, we would be able to demonstrate its weaknesses by the 1960 election and get much stronger legislation. With the bill passed, we were in a better position to campaign than we would have been without it. At the end of that long afternoon, I decided to buck the prevailing sentiment against the bill and support it. That decision, Wilkins was to say, was one of the hardest I have ever made. But it was crucial. Johnson had persuaded Graham, and Graham had persuaded Rao, and Rao had persuaded Wilkins. And now, in that law library on K Street, Wilkins persuaded the leadership conference. In the late afternoon, at the end of a long day, the conference issued a statement saying that, disappointing as the Senate version is, it does contain some potential good, and therefore should be passed. The Washington Post found the statement good. The 16 national organizations have taken a realistic view, said its editorial the next day. All of them recognize that an amended bill is vastly preferable to no bill at all. It is noteworthy that among the signers is Roy Wilkins. The Senate vote on the overall bill began at about 8 o'clock that Wednesday night, by which time the leadership conference statement supporting the measure had been circulated on Capitol Hill. Its passage had already been assured, but it had been expected that some Republicans and liberals would join the South in voting against it. The statement changed that, even for Noland. With the pending bill, we have made some advances in civil rights, the Republican leader said in his closing statement. And the bill, he said, will be further improved in the conference committee. It will be greatly improved over the Senate version. Not a single Republican and only one liberal, Wayne Morse, voted against it. Only 17 of the 22 Southern senators joined Morse in voting against the bill. Florida's Smathers voted for it, as did Tennessee's Gore and Kefauver, and the two senators from Texas, Ralph Yarborough and Lyndon Johnson. Five senators didn't vote, and the vote for passage, the decisive vote in the 1957 civil rights fight, the first time in 82 years, the first time since Reconstruction that the Senate had passed a civil rights bill, was 72-18. The next morning, at about 6 o'clock, Rao received another telephone call, this time from Phil Graham. "I just had the strangest call," Graham said. "I had the strangest call from Lyndon." He said, "Phil, of all the strange things, who the hell do you think is saving that bill for me? That crazy goddamned friend of yours, Joe Rao, is saving that bill for me." "I wasn't saving it for him because I hated his guts for what he was doing to school desegregation," Rao was to say. "That was a crime against the Negroes when Lyndon Johnson knocked out Part 3. But Johnson was right. We had to have a breakthrough." 35 years later, when Joe Rao died, Catherine Graham summed it up in the eulogy she delivered at his memorial service. "Joe understood that you had to show you could pass something, even something small, to go forward and pass something big." Whether or not Joe Rao saved the civil rights bill, he certainly smoothed the way for the next steps needed if it was to become law. For more than 2 weeks following that Senate vote, Republicans sincerely committed to civil rights, notably New Yorkers Brownell, Rogers, and Congressman Kenneth Keating, insisted, as did Noland and Joe Martin, both of them still unable to grasp the strategic situation, that the House reject the Senate version and repass its original, stronger version of the bill. Unless major steps were taken to put more teeth back into the measure, Martin said on August 10th, the bill would be sent to a joint House-Senate conference committee, where, of course, it would die. But the Civil Rights Leadership Conference issued another statement, reiterating that the Senate version should be accepted as the best that was realistically possible. With that statement, the opposition to the bill crumbled. How could anyone contend that a civil rights bill should not be passed when the preeminent civil rights organization said it should? Noland and Martin continued to bluster to reporters, Martin saying that it would be infinitely better to have no bill than to pass one as bitterly disappointing to America's Negroes as the one the Senate had passed, and threatening to withhold Republican support from the bill and have the Republicans on the conference committee hold the bill there indefinitely until it was strengthened. But there was one question, asked by reporters virtually every time Noland or Martin made such statements, which punctured their bravado, a question to which every possible response was lame. As the New York Times put it, asked how he reconciled this statement with the fact that the NAACP was seeking approval of the Senate bill as the best available, Martin replied that the NAACP leaders did not speak for all Negroes. There was bluster, too, in the weekly meetings of GOP legislative leaders at the White House. Brownell's deputy Rogers called the bill a monstrosity, the most irresponsible act he had seen during his time in Washington. The revised Section 4 limited to voting rights and providing for jury trials would be like giving a policeman a gun without bullets. The president, apparently firmly convinced by Brownell and Rogers of the unwisdom of a jury trial amendment, supported them. At one meeting, the minutes reported, "The president spoke at length in favor of fighting it out to the end to prevent the pseudo-liberals from getting away with their sudden alliance with the Southerners on a sham bill. The president thought it ironic that the Democrats had succeeded in making it appear that any civil rights legislation that might be enacted would be their proposal." But there was a master of realpolitik in the room. The vice president summarized that the Republicans would be blamed for any failure to enact civil rights legislation in the event that Republicans voted to send the bill to conference, a conference committee, and it died there. Eventually, Nixon's pragmatism carried the day in Republican councils. On the Democratic side of the House, there were no councils. Sam Rayburn made his wishes known. On August 27th, by a vote of 279-97, the House accepted the Senate bill with only one minor change. A face-saving compromise Johnson had worked out that slightly diluted the jury trial amendment and therefore slightly strengthened the bill. It allowed judges to try minor voting rights offenses without a jury. That crucial vote, unexpected in its one-sidedness, meant the measure could go back to the Senate. And if the Senate accepted that change, repassing the bill with that one change written into it, the bill would not go to conference. More than a few of the Southern senators, most notably Thurmond, Talmadge, and Harry Byrd, did not want to accept that change, and they felt they didn't have to. That the year was by now so far advanced, and senators so eager to get out of Washington, that the will and the votes to close off a filibuster did not exist, if indeed they ever had. When, however, Thurmond attempted to persuade the Southern caucus to filibuster, Dick Russell countered with the same reasoning he had been using all year to deflect one. The Southerners could use that reasoning to deflect the anger of constituents over their failure to filibuster, and they did. As Willis Robertson wrote one constituent, "I can assure you that a careful appraisal of the situation confronting us convinces the Southern senators that if we attempt a filibuster, cloture would promptly be imposed, in which event not only would we lose our present fight, but would invite the establishment of a precedent to plague us next year should an effort be made to amend Rule 22. And in the end, all of the Southerners but one agreed, as usual, to accept their general's decision. When the bill returned to the Senate, Strom Thurmond held the floor for 24 hours and 18 minutes, the longest one-man filibuster in the Senate's history, drawling out the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and George Washington's farewell address. But that scene from the Senate's past was a solo performance. None of his fellow Southerners would join him, and they were furious at him because they felt he was showing them up for not filibustering themselves. They felt, as one article said, that Mr. Thurmond was leaving in the South a public image of a single Southern senator standing at barricades that had been deserted by the others. Oh God, the venomous hatred of his Southern colleagues, George Reedy was to recall. I'll never forget Herman Talmadge's eyes when he walked in on the floor of the Senate that day and saw Strom carrying on that performance. Even Russell, faced with what the Atlanta Constitution called rumblings of criticism that are being heard in Georgia, felt a need to justify his strategy, telling the Constitution that the South had nothing to gain and everything to lose by filibustering, and declaring, "Under the circumstances we faced, if I had undertaken a filibuster for personal aggrandizement, I would forever have reproached myself for being guilty of a form of treason against the South." 35 years later, Thurmond himself, his biographer Nadine Cahodas wrote, was still adamant that a full-scale filibuster would have been successful if Russell had gone along. He refused to concede that the Georgians' tactical compromises were necessary, and remained convinced that Russell was motivated more by a desire to help Lyndon Johnson pass a civil rights bill, and thereby boost the Texans' presidential hopes, than by a wish to protect the South or the filibuster rule. When Thurmond finished talking, the Senate, on August 29th, passed the revised bill by a 60-15 vote, and on September 9th, President Eisenhower signed it into law. August 27th, the day of the crucial House of Representatives vote to approve the Senate's version of the 1957 Civil Rights Act, was Lyndon Johnson's 49th birthday. His 40th birthday had been a very bad day in his life, a day on which it had seemed likely that he would never sit in the United States Senate. August 27, 1948, had been the eve of Election Day in his senatorial contest with Coke Stevenson, and polls taken that election eve showed that Stevenson was still solidly ahead. Johnson was intending to leave politics forever if he lost that election, and on his birthday it had seemed likely that he would lose. He was convinced that a man's 40th birthday was a milestone in his life, that if he hadn't accomplished anything by 40, he was unlikely ever to accomplish anything. On his 40th birthday, Horace Busby recalls, he felt he had done very little in his life, and he felt that he never would. August 27th, 1957, was a very different day. He had come a long way in the 9 years since 1948, and on this day, the day on which the House vote made his great achievement a certainty, he seemed to know it. He spent much of the day in the Senate Democratic cloakroom that he had made his domain, telephoning the 20 Texas representatives in the House to try to persuade them to vote for the bill, and in the end, 12 of the 20 voted for it, a small exclamation point accentuating his triumph. During the day, Mary Rather came to the door of the cloakroom with a message that meant a lot to him. That morning's Baltimore Sun had contained a favorable cartoon by Richard Yardley, whose drawings were a barometer of liberal opinion. He had told Willie Day Taylor to ask Yardley for the original. Willie Day had done so, and when Yardley agreed, had invited him to see the cartoon collection in Johnson's office. Yardley said he would like to, but I'd like to come see them hanging in the White House. Ms. Rather relayed the message to Johnson, and when she returned to the Senate office building, told Willie Day his reaction. This message made our tired boss smile. And there would be, that day, broader smiles. The team that had won the Little League Baseball World Championship was brought to the Capitol steps to meet the majority leader, and the team was from Monterrey, Mexico. As the little Mexican boys clustered around him, one of them, Angel Macias, handed him his baseball cap, and Lyndon Johnson suddenly bent down and scooped Angel up, holding him in one arm while he tried on the cap with the other. 30 years before, he had made it possible for the Mexican boys in Catala to play baseball, and it had hurt him when, in the early mornings, he had heard trucks taking them away instead. He had wanted to do something for them and had promised himself that if ever he had the power, he would. And now, on Lyndon Johnson's face as he held the little Mexican boy in his arms, posing for a photographer, was an expression that photographers almost never caught. An expression that was almost never on Johnson's face when a camera was pointed at it, because he always wanted to look statesmanlike or shrewd, so that when a camera was pointing at him, he looked either solemn and pompous or calculating. On his face this time, as Angel Macias hugged him, and Lyndon Johnson tilted the baseball cap back as the photographer asked, was a wide, carefree smile, a smile that lit up his whole face, a smile as big and lighthearted, as happy as the smile of the little boy grinning up at him. That evening, at about 6 o'clock, there was a little party in Skeeter's office to cut his birthday cake.